Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Ho, Senior Fellow at the Center for International Policy, who assesses the deteriorating military situation in Afghanistan, prospects for peace talks, and concern that the U.S. will remain mired in an endless war. Cynthia Sartu of the Gulf Restoration Network, who talks about the ongoing environmental and economic challenges facing New Orleans, 10 years after Hurricane Katrina and 5 years after the BP oil disaster. And Eric Kingson of the Strengthen Social Security Campaign, who explains the current impasse in Congress over adjustments necessary to ensure that the Social Security Disability Fund won't be forced to make major benefit cuts. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the run-up to this fall's Paris Climate Summit, China, the world's largest emitter of carbon dioxide, set ambitious new targets in July to reduce the country's output of CO2. A study by researchers at the London School of Economics has projected that China could meet its new climate goals earlier than expected. China has pledged to reduce its carbon emissions by 65% by the year 2030. Much of the optimism about China's regulation of carbon comes from reports that average carbon emissions from 2014 to 2015 were reduced by half a percentage point above its targets. Beijing has succeeded in dramatically boosting energy efficiency and speeding its transition to renewable energy sources. Even with China's ambitious carbon reduction targets, the country's overall CO2 emissions will continue to grow. China could account for half of all global carbon emissions in 15 years. Today, the United States is responsible for 15% of global carbon pollution, and the Obama administration has pledged to reduce carbon output by 26 to 28% below 2005 emission levels in advance of the global climate talks in Paris this December. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry attended a historic ceremony in Havana on August 14th, where the American flag was raised at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba for the first time in 54 years. But while the two countries have moved forward to normalize relations, the agenda has been limited to negotiating routine matters such as restoring postal deliveries and expanding air travel. When talks on normalizing U.S.-Cuba relations got underway, Cuba's Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez made three fundamental demands on the Obama White House: an end to the economic embargo, return of the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, and reparations for economic and human damages caused by the 50-year trade embargo. Political observers say the Obama administration has limited ability to reverse the economic embargo in Congress, where it is strongly supported by top congressional Republicans. At a July press conference, U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter insisted there is no plan at present to return the Guantanamo Navy base to Cuba, even as Washington stands accused of inflicting torture on terrorism detainees held there since 9/11. 116 detainees still remain at the base. An investigation by The Guardian newspaper reports that over the last decade, the Chicago Police Department has detained more than 3,500 people in a West Side warehouse known as Holman Square. Some 80% of the detainees were African American, and only three suspects were allowed visits by defense attorneys. For months, the Chicago Police Department insisted the warehouse was not a secret detention center, but a place where undercover police worked. Department supervisors maintained that all suspects taken to Holman Square were documented. Records obtained by The Guardian indicate that only 9% of the suspects taken to Holman, mostly on drug charges, were white, in a city where over a third of the population is white. Two-thirds of the arrests occurred under the administration of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, the former Obama White House chief of staff, who took office in May 2011. Longtime civil rights lawyer Flint Taylor, who pressured Mayor Emanuel to create a fund for victims of police torture, commented, "I am extremely troubled but not shocked at the exceedingly broad scope and fundamental racist nature of unconstitutional police conduct at Holman Square. The police are still using Holman Square as a detention facility. At least 118 people have been detained there since February 24th, the date when The Guardian newspaper published its first article about the detention warehouse." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While President Obama had planned to end the U.S. war in Afghanistan by the time he leaves office in January 2017, the escalation of Taliban attacks and the rise of ISIS in the war-torn country threatens to derail that timetable. Most U.S. combat troops were withdrawn from Afghanistan at the end of 2014, leaving behind some 10,000 American soldiers in the role of advisors and as a counterterrorism quick reaction force. Half of those troops were scheduled to leave in 2016, but in March, President Obama announced that he would slow down the withdrawal schedule, leaving some or all of the troops in place through the end of next year. America's longest war, which was launched soon after the 9/11 attacks, has cost the lives of some 91,000 Afghans, over 2,300 U.S. soldiers, and nearly $1 trillion. But the commitment of blood and treasure has done little to stabilize the country. And with a new threat emerging from the Islamic State, there are likely darker days ahead. The reported death of Taliban leader Mullah Omar has led to divisions within the insurgent force. The vacuum of leadership has coincided with the launch of Pakistan-brokered peace talks between the government of Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and a Taliban faction that favors negotiations. But as the talks got underway, the country has suffered a wave of deadly Taliban suicide bomb attacks that have targeted a U.S. base, a police academy, and the capital's international airport. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Ho, a former Marine captain and Iraq War veteran, resigned his State Department post in Afghanistan in 2009 in protest of American policy in the Afghan War. Here he assesses the current military and political situation in Afghanistan, the prospects for peace talks, and concerned that the U.S. could remain mired in an endless war.
But I mean, basically, Scott, the country is in political chaos. Ashraf Ghani, who was more or less kind of handpicked by the American government, he was the favorite horse in the presidential election last year from the American perspective, won an election that was incredibly crooked. The European Union's audit of the ballot fraud was their results was that it was just absolutely stupendous, absolutely spectacular, unlike anything anyone had seen before. And you're talking about an election that comes on the back of Hamid Karzai's stolen election. So for them to use such adjective really shows how corrupt, how much a sham the democracy in Afghanistan actually is. Of course, Ghani wasn't the only one participating in the fraud. Everyone was committing fraud. The Taliban, while their supreme leader, Mullah Omar, was recently announced that he has died anywhere from 2 weeks ago to 2 years ago. No one really seems to be sure. We do know that despite the rhetoric coming from the American side and the Afghan government side, the Taliban are in a very good position. They are launching record numbers of attacks every year. They have seized a lot of terrain that they have forfeited to American and foreign forces. They just came right back in once the American foreign forces left, which is basically what anyone would tell you was going to happen. You know, the country is in chaos. There is no economy. The only economy that is really viable in that country is the drug trade. So unfortunately, for the Afghans, this war, this surge that President Obama authorized 6 years ago, which saw us set go from 30,000 American troops to over 100,000 American troops in Afghanistan, really did nothing other than escalate the violence. And so we don't see an establishment of control by the government in Kabul. We don't see a coherent or a legitimate government in Kabul. We don't see a degraded Taliban. And most frightening of all, we see the Islamic State now in Afghanistan, which really goes to show that, as you know, myself and others have argued, the use of American military force in the Middle East has been counterproductive, and it has only been utilized to an effect in a positive manner by those organizations like Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State that can utilize the propaganda of defending the Muslim countries against the Western crusader, which, of course, by the presence of our hundreds of thousands of troops, our drones, our aircraft, our bombs, et cetera, our support for dictators or corrupt governments like Ashraf Ghani's in Afghanistan, then, of course, that validates their propaganda and gets them recruits. So the assessment, Scott, long way of saying is basically our policy in Afghanistan has failed.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, from what I've read, is undertaking an outreach campaign to the government in Pakistan, and there are reports of new Pakistan-brokered peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Do you have any hope that those negotiations could bear fruit in terms of a cessation of hostilities and an end to this horrendous war that's going on for so long?
I don't have a lot of hope for it. The problem, again, goes back to our decisions in 2008, 2009, 2010, the American government decision to win this war militarily. And one of the reasons why I resigned was we were making no effort to solve the war politically, and we had outreach from the insurgency, not from the entire insurgency, but we had elements of the insurgency, significant portions of it, saying they're interested in talking. I actually had emissaries come in, I was there at the State Department, come in and say, hey, we want to talk. And the American position was that, no, we're not going to talk, we're going to win. And so now you have this understanding within the Taliban that, look, we are so close to winning, why should we negotiate?
Matthew, what is the danger you see in terms of the Obama administration and the temptation they may have to reverse the troop withdrawal and actually put more troops back in? There's already reports of a dramatic increase in airstrikes and drone strikes to assist the Afghan army and police to deflect these new wave of attacks by the Taliban.
I think it's a very real danger, Scott, as you referenced the idea of America re-engaging in Afghanistan, basically jumping back into the quicksand, so to speak. And I think President Obama has tremendous political pressure on him. He is blamed, of course, and I completely disagree with it, but he is blamed, of course, for pulling the troops too quickly out of Iraq, and that's why the Islamic State and the chaos that's occurring in Iraq and Syria, like I said, I don't believe that, but that's the attacks against him. I can't imagine he wants to leave office being known as the president who lost Afghanistan, particularly since he campaigned in 2008 so strongly on Iraq with the bad war, Afghanistan with the good war. He was going to get the troops out of Iraq into Afghanistan and win the good war. But it's a very real danger that the president, because of political pressure, will have to reintroduce American forces to save face, American face in Afghanistan.
That was Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Learn more about the current military and political situation in Afghanistan by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. August 29th marks the 10th anniversary of the destruction wrought by Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans and along the Louisiana and Mississippi Gulf coasts. The bulk of the damage in New Orleans occurred as a result of the failure of Mississippi River levees, which inundated vast swaths of the city. The devastating flood led to the horrific iconic images of residents frantically calling for help from their rooftops and of thousands of storm refugees stranded for days in the Superdome without adequate food and water. New Orleans is 100 miles upriver from the Gulf of Mexico, where damage resulted more from the impact of Katrina's winds and waves on already compromised wetlands. These wetlands have been destroyed over the past half century by oil and gas development, the natural sinking of the land, and the rise in sea level due to climate change. 5 years after Katrina, the BP oil disaster devastated the area again in 2010. Effects of the massive oil spill are still being felt today, both in the ecosystem and in human health. Many residents say a recent $18 billion settlement from BP will help, but is not enough to restore the area or compensate workers or businesses who lost everything. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Cynthia Sartu, the longtime executive director of the Gulf Restoration Network based in New Orleans. Here she highlights some of the ongoing challenges facing the Gulf Coast before the region can recover and thrive.
Sadly, 5 years after the storm, many communities, particularly communities dependent on natural resources like fish and shrimp, were heavily hit during Katrina because of loss of equipment and just upheaval. And 5 years after the hurricane, that fishing community was just coming back. They were really, you know, thinking that 2010 would be their big year. They could recover all their losses and return to status quo. And they were then hit with the BP disaster. So many members of that community have been devastated. They have not recovered from the BP disaster, despite all the media otherwise. They're hanging on by a thread. Shrimp prices and shrimp imports are adding to the injury, and some are predicting that most of that community will not survive as a result of all this. So that traditional live-from-the-land community that made up coastal Louisiana is right now very much at risk, and sadly, it was the BP disaster on the heels of Hurricane Katrina that put them there.
For years, I've been hearing that coastal Louisiana loses a football field worth of land every 45 minutes, that it just slips into the Gulf. Has that land loss accelerated, slowed down, or stayed the same in the past few years?
There's been a little bit of slowdown, not a lot. There's been a little, and there is movement. We now have a state master plan, and the state of Louisiana has been very good about focusing all of the money they can get on that master plan and has begun restoration projects, which are focused on making communities more resilient, but that restoration process is going to take a long time. But at the same time, nobody in the United States has really taken action to reduce the impacts of climate change, and we are ground zero for sea level rise. And I'm hearing predictions that in some parts of even New Orleans, if you take into account both sea level rise and subsidence, which is soil compaction, that some places may be as much as 15 feet below sea level that are now maybe at sea level. So we are facing not just status quo. The concerns for scientists and the state in terms of restoration are things aren't going to be status quo, just as they're not going to be status quo in any coastal community.
What's the position of your governor, Bobby Jindal, regarding climate change? And, of course, he's also running for the Republican nomination for president.
He's a big climate change denier. He will talk about sea level rise, but they won't really. The state has, according to NOAA at least, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the state is way underestimating sea level rise, and they are total deniers of climate change and, in fact, are one of the groups that has sued the president over almost anything having to do with attempts to reduce greenhouse gases or otherwise reduce the impacts of climate change.
Cynthia Sartu, I'm reading a fascinating book now called Rising Tide. It's about the 1927 Mississippi River flood and how it changed America. It was amazing to me that despite the insistence of the top engineers of the turn of the 20th century that a levees-only policy would be a disaster, that's exactly the policy that was followed to try to control the river.
I don't think we have, at this time, a levees-only. The state has actually acknowledged the need for what's called the multiple lines of defense strategy, which means that you have to marry coastal restoration outside the levees with some structural protections like levees or roads that are elevated, then married with things like home elevation, green infrastructure inside the levees, and then, of course, evacuation. So it's called the multiple lines of defense strategy. The concern is that people's first knee-jerk reaction is, give us a levee will protect us. Sadly, as Katrina taught us, and this hasn't changed any at all, levees alone are not enough. Levees without wetlands are not very protected and are not very sturdy. What you need to do is have environmental protections. The problem really is sort of the same thing as coastal restoration for us, is that there's been money for levees. You know, the Corps has rebuilt levees and rebuilt storm surge barriers, and I don't know that they're stronger than ever, but they've made them as strong as they can, and they're still having to revisit some of them because subsidence has been faster than they projected. But what hasn't really happened is the money has not come in for comprehensive wetland restoration in front of those levees that's needed to really dampen storm surge.
So 10 years after Katrina and 5 years after the BP disaster, how would you sum up the situation for New Orleans and the Louisiana coast?
I've been just a little bit concerned because I hear even in New Orleans that, oh, New Orleans is back. We're as resilient as we ever have been. We're stronger than ever. And to be honest, I mean, New Orleans since Katrina is not stronger than ever. I told somebody the other day, we're stronger than we were the day before Katrina. But really, the lines of defense needed haven't been restored.
That was Cynthia Sartu, Executive Director of the Gulf Restoration Network. Find more news and commentary on the environmental and economic challenges facing New Orleans by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the nation's popular Social Security system celebrated its 80th birthday on August 14th, the program signed into law by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1935 faced a new challenge. The annual report issued by Social Security trustees in late July warned, Social Security's Disability Insurance Trust Fund now faces an urgent threat of reserve depletion, requiring prompt corrective action by lawmakers if sudden reductions or interruptions in benefit payments are to be avoided. The report assured the public that Social Security's retirement fund will remain solvent until 2035 without further adjustments, a year later than previously estimated. Although congressional legislators had anticipated the need to replenish the Disability Insurance Trust Fund in 2016, the last time they had adjusted the program in 1994, a new hostage situation appears to be underway in Washington. Republican lawmakers are resisting implementing a simple solution to the disability fund shortfall that would redirect tax revenue from the retirement fund to the disability fund, as has been done in the past. But without congressional action, 11 million of the nation's disabled workers will face a 19% cut to their benefit payments by the end of 2016. Congressional Democrats accused the GOP of manufacturing an artificial crisis in order to force through on popular changes to Social Security that could include an increase in the retirement age and or benefit cuts. Your reporter spoke with Eric Kingson, co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign and author, who discusses the current debate in Congress over adjustments necessary to ensure that the Social Security Disability Fund won't be forced to make major benefit cuts.
There are two trust funds: the Social Security Old Age Survivors Insurance Trust Fund and Disability Insurance Trust Fund. Essentially, the system is one system. Here's what's coming up. 11 times in the past, we've had minor or major rebalancing between the two trust funds. We're in a period in which the disability trust funds will be exhausted to the point that it would require a reduction in benefits sometime around the end of 2016, right after the presidential election. We have had this happen 11 times before, and we've simply made little changes. In 1983, we moved a lot of money from the Disability Insurance Trust Fund into the Social Security OASI Trust Fund. So we've taken from disability, we've taken from OASI. Right now, we need to make a small adjustment and rebalancing and put DI on the same basis as OASI. It can be done, and it's been done 11 times without fanfare, but on the very first day of the Congress, the new Congress, there was a call for a rules change which basically holds Social Security hostage. They're trying to create a crisis, and they're sending a message out that if we don't address this problem, we're going to have to cut benefits for people with disabilities by 19%. The truth is, it's a small thing. It can be done, but they're using it as an opportunity to try to bring about a variety of changes in Social Security that won't be good for people with disabilities or people receiving Social Security as old age or survivors.
Eric, tell us about Republicans in Congress and what kind of changes to Social Security they're trying to extract by using this particular crisis with a disability fund as leverage.
Well, I think you'd find raising retirement age, changing the benefit formula in ways that would cut benefits for younger Americans very significantly. Some of them would like a partial privatization. Fundamentally, all their focus is on cutting. And it's in an environment where our public, our working people, have seen losses of income, losses of wage increases. Remembering, since 1980, all of the income growth has gone to the top 10%, mostly the top 1 and 0.1%. None of it, on average, has gone to the bottom 90%. So it's in this context that some are still coming back and saying, well, let's go after Social Security. Let's take a few dollars. Let's carve away some dollars here and there. So if you raise retirement age, for instance, every year you raise it, that's about a 7% cut, no matter when you take it. So we're already raising it by 2 years on people born after 1959. And what many of them have been saying is, let's think about raising it to age 70.
Eric, what's the end game here with this conflict in Congress over funding the Social Security Disability Fund? What's the role of the public?
The end game for the ones who are creating this crisis, just like they created a debt ceiling crisis and other crises that have been created, is to try to force action and to force action outside of the view of the public in the context of a crisis. The end game for the public is to get the word to their representatives and to get on the telephone and also write in local newspapers and talk about the real circumstances. And let me just switch from, it's not only about not cutting. We have a system that works. We can afford all of it. We can do things that are relatively modest. We can ask millionaires and billionaires to pay the same Social Security payroll rate as everyone else. And that would address 80% of this projected shortfall in Social Security generally. We could have very modest, small increases in payroll contributions over 20 years. The public has generally, in polling, shown that they would much prefer, not having Social Security cut and having benefits increased, and that they're willing to pay for it with contributions. But the bottom line is really getting those who've done so extremely well in the economic lottery to pay their fair share.
That was Eric Kingson, co-author of the book Social Security Works and co-director of the Strengthen Social Security campaign, currently on leave while he runs for Congress from New York State's 24th District. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to protect Social Security by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.